Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hull International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. This is the first part of the fourth episode of season two. Last time I discussed, among other things, the gradually accelerating increase in London's population between 1550 and 1900. That slow explosion benefited the city in many ways, not least because it brought in the entrepreneurial energy of economic migrants like Samuel Whitbread. But it also created some terrible problems, which Londoners have often been painfully slow to address. The most visible of these, which provides the context for this two-part episode, was the insufficient supply of adequate places to live. After some preparation and a bit of digression, we will explore three housing estates around Whitecross Street, Peabody Town, Golden Lane, and the Barbican, and we will consider how they did and did not address this problem. But we must, ho, 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 lay the foundations first. For centuries, many Londoners lived in squalor, and a shameful number continue to do so. The basic equation is simple. Population increased, housing stock did not, so the living space available for each individual shrank. Moreover, buildings deteriorated over time, so many Londoners lived in smaller, more crowded, dingier, unhealthier places than their predecessors, if they lived anywhere at all. The reasons for the early phase of this long crisis are, I think, complex. Some were simply practical. London's geography made expansion on its outskirts difficult. The other side of the Thames was not easy to reach, and much of the land on the edge of town was marshy and hard to build on. The area around Whitecross Street is a good example. Building further away, in an age without cheap, quick, reliable mass transportation, was pointless. Another practical problem, building materials were not readily available. Other issues were cultural. Medieval London was ringed by monastic institutions, and they did not readily develop or sell land for housing. After the Reformation, much of that land was owned by aristocratic families, or the crown, who were likewise reluctant to build. Another psychological issue related to the centrality of the parish in early modern social life. London's immigrants were not thought of as the responsibility of Londoners. They belonged to their birthplaces. The stock response to vagrants, as Elizabethans called the homeless, was to whip them, then to send them home. So an increasing population was crammed more and more tightly into existing, aging housing stock with a corresponding increase in disease, crime, and misery. The Great Fire changed the shape of this problem, but certainly did not help solve it. In the aftermath, the worst neighborhoods were in the near suburbs, which had not burnt and thus had not been rebuilt, like Whitechapel and, well, Whitecross Street. In the 18th century, new bridges made developments across the river more accessible, but supply could not match demand. There was no significant attempt to address this problem directly until the 19th century. Again, the reasons for this were largely cultural. London had no comprehensive government. Outside the city, local authorities of various kinds held sway, and they did not have the economic or human resources to engage in expensive development, which would then have to be expensively managed. And in any case, the welfare of citizens was not seen as the responsibility of government. Even in the 19th century, efforts were initiated and funded by private citizens and organizations. Influential and wealthy Londoners were involved, government was not. Attempts were frequent, imaginative, and benevolent, but they were neither adequate in scale nor coordinated in planning. So we come to the subject of today's episode, George Peabody, the Peabody Development Fund, and the two Peabody estates on either side of Whitecross Street. George Peabody's life is too interesting to ignore, so I hope you will forgive a digression. He was born in South Danvers, Massachusetts in 1795. You won't find South Danvers on a map today, because in 1868, a year before he died, it was renamed Peabody after its most famous son. The Peabodys were one of the oldest white families in the state, but not all Peabodys were wealthy and influential. George grew up poor and had only 4 years of schooling. His father died when he was a teenager, and George went to work in his brother's village shop. His big break seems to have come while serving in the War of 1812. He met Elisha Riggs, who after their discharge took him on as a partner in a large-scale dry goods enterprise. In 1816, Peabody moved to Baltimore, Maryland, where Riggs, Peabody & Company was very successful exporting and arranging finance for the export of American agricultural products. I do not know to what extent this involved trade in goods grown by enslaved people, but Maryland was a slave state, so it seems likely. In the late 1820s, Peabody began making trips to the great financial centers of Europe to arrange for the sale of the state bonds, which were funding the improvement of infrastructure in the rapidly developing American economy. And in 1837, he moved to London, then the center of international finance, and lived here for the rest of his life. His reputation was made when Maryland defaulted on its debt in 1845, and Peabody negotiated a resumption of payments with great energy, ingenuity, and some personal risk. He went on to arrange loans to fund the American War with Mexico, the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. This was the great age of railroad building in the eastern U.S., and Peabody became one of the great financiers of that expansion. In 1851, he set up what we would now call a merchant bank, George Peabody & Company, and in 1854, he took on a young J.S. Morgan, father of J.P. Morgan, as a junior partner. That company eventually became Morgan Grenfell. Peabody was a great and extraordinarily successful banker, but that is not why he's remembered today. His biographer calls him the father of modern philanthropy, and certainly in the range of his causes and the size of his gifts, his benevolence was unprecedented. His fortune has been estimated at $15 to $20 million. Modern equivalencies are hard to calculate, but that might be about $2 to $3 billion today. By the end of his life, he had given at least half of it away. He began patriotically. The American display at the Great Exhibition of 1851 was threatened when the federal government declined to support it. Peabody stepped in with a gift of $10,000, $1 to $2 million today, and national honor was preserved. Perhaps significantly, the highlight of the American exhibits was Hiram Power's allegorically abolitionist sculpture, The Greek Slave. That gift was typical. Peabody remained an American citizen all his life, and though he made most of his money in London, his philanthropy mostly benefited the land of his birth. He funded libraries and cultural centers in his hometown, in Baltimore, in a host of American towns and cities. He endowed museums and other facilities at Harvard, Yale, and a bunch of other universities. His enormous education fund endowed teacher training colleges and other higher education all over the United States, particularly in the former Confederacy after the Civil War. His beneficiaries were Americans of color, as well as whites. But London was certainly not neglected. In 1862, Peabody gave £150,000 to establish the Peabody Donation Fund for the benefit of London's poor. The terms of this enormous gift were startlingly simple. In Peabody's words, the brief was to ameliorate the condition and augment the comforts of the poor, who either by birth or established residence form a recognized portion of the population of London. No particular benefit was mandated, no precise definition of poverty was given, beneficiaries did not have to be native Londoners or even British. nor were they excluded because of religion or politics or any other affiliation. The governance structure of the fund was as unusual as the breadth of its aims. Peabody appointed a board of 5 directors and allowed it complete freedom to manage the organization. It was the board's choice, not his, to focus on housing, and its choice, not his, to provide housing not for the very poor, but for those in regular employment. Peabody did not set detailed goals for the charity, detailed procedures for choosing beneficiaries, or detailed criteria for selecting employees. He showed his approval and continuing engagement not by interference, but by making further donations. By the time he died 7 years later, he had given the fund £500,000, hundreds of millions in today's money. But one of his greatest gifts to it was autonomy. In allowing the managers to manage, he certainly was a pioneer of the modern charitable foundation and created a durable and effective institution. It flourishes today. As I hinted just now, the directors decided that the fund would be devoted to alleviating London's housing shortage, but not to housing the poorest Londoners. The reasons are interesting. First, they thought the poorest of the poor were beyond help. One director said explicitly that people used to living in dark, dank cellars or on the street would be unable to cope with light and warmth and space. Second, they thought that such people would damage the housing provided and make it unattractive to others. Third, they wanted to charge rent so that they could maintain their properties and fund future development. So tenants went through a selection process to guarantee that they had regular paid employment and a regular lifestyle. They didn't have to be rich, but they had to be reliable, even respectable. For the first of its projects, the fund bought property at the corner of Commercial and Folgate Streets in Spitalfields. Existing structures were demolished and therefore current residents evicted, and Henry Derbyshire was employed to build one of London's first apartment blocks. He would continue to design the fund's buildings for decades, creating some of the first apartment blocks in London. If you know London well enough to have a mental image of a Peabody estate, you are almost certainly thinking of his work. Unlike later developments, the first Peabody block had shops on the ground floor, but the housing provided was typical. Flats varied in size from 1 to 3 rooms. There were several on each floor, sharing toilets and kitchens. The building had communal facilities for bathing and laundry in the attic and basement. It also had a full-time manager whose job was not merely to maintain the physical space, but also to monitor the tenants' behavior. Rules included a ban on wallpaper and picture hooks, and another on subletting. Smallpox vaccinations were mandatory. Life on a Peabody estate was highly organized and carefully regulated, but the flats, relatively cheap, relatively spacious, relatively light, relatively sanitary, well-equipped, well-maintained, were far better than those typically available on the open market. The fund in Derbyshire refined their model in later developments and built on a larger scale, particularly south of the Thames, where land was significantly cheaper. By the 1870s, a Peabody estate would be composed of several 4 to 6 story brick blocks set around communal open ground, with the buildings widely spaced enough so that all the flats were well lit and airy. Flats were supplied with piped water and gas, though toilets, kitchens, and washing facilities continued to be shared. The estates also had a communal culture. Activities, associations, events were arranged by tenants and supported by the management. Even though apartment buildings remained an alien form of housing in London, the flats were very much in demand, particularly by families with children. Waiting lists were years long. But new estates could have an odd impact on London's housing shortage, often more people were displaced by a new development than were housed by it. And those displaced were often not the sort of people the board wanted to house. That anomaly was about to get worse. In 1875, Parliament passed the Artisans and Labourers Dwellings Improvement Act, which gave London's municipal authority, the Metropolitan Board of Works, the power of compulsory purchase of London property to create new housing. The board was eager to exercise that power, but reluctant to go into large-scale residential development or management. It was also aware that private charities, notably the Peabody Donation Fund, had the experience and expertise to build and run housing estates effectively. Like George Peabody himself, they wanted to finance and facilitate, but not to manage. Meanwhile, the pace of the fund's building had slowed because London land was increasingly expensive. So the two organizations went into partnership. The board would purchase land and the fund would build and run housing estates on it. The result was a burst of new activity. 8 new estates, including Roscoe Street and Whitecross Street. These, finished in 1883, were the two biggest developments the fund ever undertook. The cost was £194,000, and the result was 33 5- and 6-story blocks built around a series of courtyards. Rents ranged from 2 shillings, perhaps £20 today, each week, but that was likely to be 10% or more of an artisan's wage for a single room, to 7 shillings a week for 4. The new development was very popular with press and public alike. The Pall Mall Gazette applauded. In place of narrow lanes and dirty courts, there are several wide, well-paved, and well-scavenged streets, and the contrast between the past and present of Upper Whitecross Street is striking. Although there was space for over 4,000 people, by 1885 there was a 2-year waiting list for vacancies. Typical residents were construction workers, policemen, tailors, bookbinders. But the Gazette's praise of Peabody Town, as they called it, hinted at the downside. People had lived in those narrow lanes and dirty courts, and the new buildings were not as densely populated as the old. In fact, slum clearance was a stated purpose of this and other developments undertaken in partnership with the Metropolitan Board of Works. It would be a stretch to call these estates an exercise in municipal gentrification, but they were definitely and explicitly what might be termed respectabilization. Contemporaries saw Peabody Town not just as a success, but as a model. Its design was widely imitated by other smaller charities and local and city authorities. The fund itself began experimenting with individual homes and what Americans would call garden apartments, so that later developments look more suburban and less institutional than Peabody Town. But the estate and other Peabody estates remained popular, happy, and well-maintained into the 20th century. They did not solve the problem of housing for London's poor, but they did provide decent living space for tens of thousands of Londoners who would not otherwise have had it. They still do. Peabody Town, like the area as a whole, had a very rough blitz. The raid of the night of the 29th of 30th, 1940, is sometimes called the Second Great Fire of London. Over 100,000 small incendiary bombs were dropped on the northern edge of the city, and a substantial fraction of them fell on Whitecross Street. Most of the buildings were hit, and every block in Peabody Town was damaged. Those on the Whitecross Street estate were reparable, but 6 on the Roscoe Street side were completely destroyed, and others were too badly damaged to be restored. Photographs of the aftermath show the area as a landscape of rubble. But from that devastation grew a new and different Peabody estate. As I mentioned earlier, the fund had begun building a wider range of housing in the early 20th century. Streets of cottages were blended with the apartment blocks that had been their staple for so long. On Roscoe Street, they tried something else. Among the 3 to 6 story blocks built on the site in the 1950s, they built 2 13-story towers, and in 1972, they added a third. They also introduced balconies and a much wider range of materials that had been used on the Victorian estates. At the same time, they renovated the surviving buildings on the Whitecross Street side, giving flats their own bathrooms and kitchens. While all this was going on, just a few meters away, the Golden Lane estate, an even more innovative approach to urban community, was also rising from the rubble. But you will have to wait for the second part of this episode to find out more about that. First, let's look back over this one. George Peabody can indeed be seen as the first modern philanthropist. The scale of his gifts, his willingness to give his trust autonomy, his unwillingness to restrict his charity to those who shared his values, opinions, or background, these seem very modern indeed. But in other respects, he seems like the last in a long line of public-spirited Londoners, people like those John Stowe had celebrated in his survey centuries before for building almshouses. But after Peabody's death, his fund's partnership with the Metropolitan Board of Works was a new approach to the perennial problem of housing Londoners decently. It still did not address the plight of the poorest, however. In fact, it arguably made their situation worse. A walk down almost any London street today will show you that the long housing crisis is still with us, and at the moment, it is getting worse. That's enough for now. Thanks for listening. Later this month, we will publish part 2 of this story, looking at 2 more developments on Whitecross Street. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.